You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world, and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy to welcome David Sten. He is a writer and filmmaker. His documentary film, Girl 27, is screening here in Santa Fe on Sunday, the 29th of July at 6 o'clock at the Jean Cocteau Cinema. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a film about a woman named Patricia Douglas, who was a young dancer in Hollywood in 1937. That was the year when she was brutally raped at a party for MGM salesmen. And it's about her attempt to get justice back in the day. How did you come across this story?
I stumbled on it accidentally. I was on deadline for my biography of Jean Harlow called Bombshell. And the week that Jean Harlow was mysteriously dying at home and the Duke of Windsor was marrying Wallace Simpson, there was another story that knocked both those stories off the front pages. And those were two of the biggest stories of the year. And it was about this dancer at MGM who was pursuing a rape case, which was unheard of in that day. And I didn't know what had happened. I'd never heard of it. I'd never read about it anywhere. If you Googled her, nothing came up, nothing. And so I started to investigate the story, assuming at first that it was possibly a shakedown of the studio rather than a legitimate case, because if it was legitimate, whatever became of her and why did the story disappear? It suggested a payoff, but of course it turned out to be the opposite. And then ultimately, when I found Patricia Douglas herself, who had been in hiding at that point for 65 years, it became an enormous and, I felt, important story.
The word rape, as you point out in the film, was virtually never used at that time. And you do a wonderful job, I have to say, it's a great film, of showing how sexual attacks were handled in Hollywood films, even in cartoons like Betty Boop. And there was so much, I mean, even as there was so much brutalization, which we see in some of these films, there was also so much blaming of the victim. What did that look like in Hollywood in the 30s?
Well, I felt like in order to tell the story of a historic rape case, it needed to be more broadly contextualized into what rape meant in a culture where it was literally a four-letter word. Newspapers would not print the word rape. So if you experienced a trauma that was unspeakable, literally, in the culture, how could you process that and how could you heal? And so what the film clips provide is an idea of, we think of old films as almost safe and very easy, but they're not. There's a lot of violence against women, very casual, the mistreatment of women. And to show that sort of in a montage within the film, and it's like an onslaught where suddenly you realize women were treated as property. And that was certainly true in Hollywood, which was an industry that commodified women. So if you look at the Busby Berkeley films, for example, these enormous dance numbers choreographed where women are objectified in this huge Olympian kind of style. And that's what Patricia did. She worked in those movies. She was a dancer. So the idea of your body not even belonging to you, and some of the women who are interviewed in the documentary who worked on those sets and talked about the pervasive sexual harassment. And when I say women, these were teenage girls. And many of them were told nothing about how to protect themselves and were on sets where the all-male crews, as one of them says in the film, it felt like open season. And these women were walking around barely dressed for their numbers. So this was the culture that this all happened in. And this party, which was a stag party for salesmen, for 282 visiting MGM convention salesmen, this was considered, and this is a quote from MGM, good, clean fun.
Good, clean fun with 500 cases of liquor for these 282 men.
Yes. And this party was held in a remote ranch that was used as a location set. So there was no transportation. There were no telephones. These women had been lured there under false pretenses. They were told it was a movie call, and they were literally trapped into service. And Patricia Douglas, who was very naive by her own admission and didn't understand what was literally happening, didn't understand that this movie set was suddenly a party and was then left to fend for herself.
One of the things that I think is so striking is the contrast between what these movies of that time make you feel, namely romance and beauty and sweetness on the one hand, and these women who were dancers, who were doing this incredibly beautiful synchronized dancing in these costumes that make you feel like the world is a beautiful place, really. And the contrast between that and what they were actually living through is so striking. I mean, it's really the light and the dark side of this concept, this sort of false construct called romance.
Yes, and it was an era that was built on romance in the popular culture, the films and the music and the fairy tale romances that you would see on the screen, which were an antidote to the depression,
Exactly.
and where people went to the movies to lose themselves literally in these romances. It was heartbreaking to see someone who felt good about herself as a dancer. She was proud of the work she did. She was the dance captain. She would instruct some of the other dancers. She learned the routines really quickly. She said to me, "I move just like J-Lo." So she really kept in touch with dancing, but after this happened, she never danced again. So they took away from her what gave her an identity and made her proud.
Meanwhile, with all of the illusion of romance, these women who were so vulnerable on set, they were put in the position of having to reject the unwanted advances of the all-male crews and of the studio executives and salesmen and basically everybody around them. And yet they were often called tarts and sluts and whores in the first place, no matter what they did, just because of their work.
Well, the double standard was pervasive. It was part of the culture. It was embedded in it. And to have these salesmen show up at a party and see these women who are in heavy camera makeup and skimpy wardrobe costumes, which they had received from Western Costume. I mean, it was all done legitimately, as all their other casting calls were up until that point. So they're in these short cowgirl outfits, heavy camera makeup. For these men from Des Moines and Dubuque and wherever they're from, they come in, they see these women, they look like party girls, euphemistically. So they make assumptions about them right from the start.
The extent to which this rape, and really, I mean, when you found these files, nobody denied that a rape had happened. It's just that they worked on a gazillion ways to cover it up. And the extent to which it was hidden for all these decades between 1937 and when you started working on it bespeaks the most thorough cover-up. This seems to be a case where everybody was complicit. What did that actually look like immediately after the attack and then in the period thereafter?
Well, first of all, being raped in 1937 and going public with it meant that you would lose your status professionally, socially, personally, you were considered, quote, damaged goods, end quote. So for her to do that was a remarkably courageous, for someone who was still a minor, she had to get her mother's permission to file charges. I mean, her mother was her legal guardian ad litem in the lawsuit. And then when the state court dismissed the case without prejudice, she filed the next day a federal civil suit. So she became the first woman in history to make rape a civil rights case. She filed a suit claiming her civil rights were violated because she had been, they had conspired to lure her to a place where she was unsafe. Now, this is before there were any kind of workplace protection laws. So this is an incredibly brave and relentless quest for justice against this machine. You know, MGM ran Hollywood. It had its own police force, which was comprised mostly of ex-LAPD cops. It had its own railway. It had its own medical clinic. It was a city within a city, and it was the largest employer in Los Angeles County. The largest donor to the DA's election campaign was Louis B. Mayer. So there was, it was a Pyrrhic victory if she had won it, and she lost it, you know. But she had to do it. She told me I had to do it so that no one would ever experience this again. I had to stop those parties from happening. And in that sense, she succeeded because the parties did not happen. But in terms of the cover-up, MGM literally wiped it from the record. I mean, I was able to find the legal files, which still survived, but no one had seen them since 1937. There was nothing ever published about this in any history of Hollywood, any history of MGM. Because they wanted it erased, and they were very effective at doing that. You had asked about MGM's smear campaign, this intensive, unprecedented character assassination, where they're hiring Pinkerton detectives to smear her and get people to perjure themselves about her. The reason they had to do that was because Patricia Douglas was a virgin when this happened. And they had to prove that she was promiscuous because a promiscuous woman can't get raped in the consideration of the culture. That was the thinking back then. So rather than bother denying that she was raped, they had to destroy her, and therefore she wasn't rapeable. That was the mindset.
And still, she had the courage to press charges. Now, one of the things that, you know, the fact that she had to press for a civil suit means right away that the police weren't doing their job. And we know this from other high-profile civil suits in our own time, that when the cops or when the justice system doesn't do its job, we still have the courts. What do you think gave her the courage to pursue this case?
I think that speaks to character. She was just one of the most remarkable people I've ever known. And I think that's clear in the film. I mean, she makes her case again. 66 years later, she gets in front of a camera, and for the first time in her life, she grants an interview about this. She refused all interviews back in 1937. She was not interested in publicity. She just wanted justice. And she had an innate sense of what was right and the right thing to do. And I admired her so much because even as a late octogenarian, she said to me, I want to do this. I want to tell my story. It took a lot of persuasion to get her to open up because nobody, when I first contacted her, she thought she was going to die with her secret. Her daughter didn't know. Her grandchildren didn't know. She had kept this buried because it was so traumatic.
Do you have any sense of how common this kind of thing was? I mean, she had this strong character, but presumably, so many other women didn't come forward.
I think it was cultural, and therefore, yes, it was common. And I think at this particular event, this party, there were other women who were assaulted. And there was someone, I had originally written the story for Vanity Fair before the documentary was made, and I was contacted by the daughter of someone, and she had very sketchy details, and together we put the pieces in place. And she had apparently been raped at this party as well and become pregnant and was sent away by her family, disgraced, and had her baby in another state under a pseudonym. And the reason I didn't use it in the documentary was because there was no proof and she never pursued any kind of legal action, whereas Patricia did. And I didn't want to do anything speculative. I think the film has all the smoking guns inside it, where you see all of the evidence of MGM's cover-up and all the evidence of her lawsuits, and you have people in the film being interviewed on camera talking about perjuring. So that to me was her case, and she tried to make that case in court. In 1937, she lost in the court of law, but she won in the court of history to me. And that's the uplifting part of her story, is by the time she passed away, she had been vindicated publicly.
Right. Well, thanks to you. I mean, she was living in silence for all of those years. And really, I mean, when you describe her life, it really did ruin her life in so many ways. She was staying up all night watching TV, sleeping all day. How did you actually find her?
I found her through a lot of hard work and a lot of brick walls. And eventually I found her by tracing. I couldn't find her because she had changed her name so many times, but I was eventually able to go in sort of through a side door because I was able to find uncles and aunts, and through them pass it along. And the irony is that once I did have the name she was using, she was listed in the phone book.
Right.
But I didn't have the name. And when I found her, the first time she hung up on me, and several other times after that, and then she would claim that she was her caretaker. So she would talk about herself in the third person. She would say, I know she won't want to talk to you. And after a few months, she finally said, you know I'm her. And I said, yes, I know, but if you felt more comfortable talking this way, I'm fine with that. And she needed to be persuaded that someone was committed to telling the truth, because after what she had been through, there was no reason to trust anyone. And it was my job to give her that reason.
And you did that through a long process of persistence and wooing. And she even talks about that a little bit in the film. It's sort of charming, the lengths to which you went to gain her trust.
Yes, we had a great relationship. I mean, she made me call her grandma. She wouldn't answer to anything but grandma. And she wouldn't leave her house. She was housebound by choice because of what had happened. But she used to send me, I was living in Los Angeles, and she would say, go to the farmer's market. And I would talk to her while I was there. I would say, I'm here. And she'd say, oh, I remember that. She said, you're my eyes, you're my ears. So it was almost like I was living vicariously for her. And we got very close, because when someone calls you and says, you don't know me, but I know your deepest, darkest secret, and I think you're a hero, it reorients your entire point of view, because she had internalized all the shame that her era foisted upon people who had been raped. And so for someone to come along and say, no, 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 you're an amazing person. You're a survivor. You're a pioneer. No one had done this before. She didn't know that. She didn't know she was the first woman in history to file a federal civil suit for rape. So I think that made her more trusting and more open. And I think she sensed that I shared her desire for justice. Like, I felt like this needed to be corrected. This story needed to be told. And I really felt that if I didn't tell it, it wouldn't get told, because once she was gone, you couldn't tell that story. It's about her, and it becomes just one person saying one thing and another person saying another thing, unless the person to whom it happened, the protagonist, is there.
Yeah. You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take just a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors. Today's program is brought to you in part by the Santa Fe Opera. The five operas in this 62nd season represent an incredibly wide variety of productions, artistically and emotionally, from hilarious comedy with Rossini's Italian Girl in Algiers to the deepest heartbreak of Madame Butterfly by Puccini, the nuclear threat of our own era with Dr. Atomic by John Adams, and Leonard Bernstein's philosophical musical Candide, and finally Richard Strauss's tale of decadent parties in Vienna. It's all there at the Santa Fe Opera, santafeopera.org. For more information and tickets, you can call 1-800-280-4654 or locally 505-986-5900. And now back to our program. Patricia Douglas, this woman, remembers that her rapist, David Ross, said to her as he was attacking her that he wanted to destroy her. And there's something so potent in that. And somehow it bespeaks something really profound about the psychology of a rapist. How do you understand this? A successful salesman wanting to destroy a teenage girl?
I have no idea what the motivation behind that would be. And it's heartbreaking to think it even exists. But I did learn that in these kinds of settings, the predator can find the prey. There were 120 dancers at that party, and some of them knew what to do. Ginger Wyatt was one of them, and she had been Miss Wichita of 1935, and she made a beeline to Wallace Beery, who was one of the stars in attendance, one of the MGM actors, and she went right up to him and said, "Get me out of here." She knew something was wrong. Patricia was bewildered. She didn't know what to do. She went into the ladies' washroom and she said to the washroom attendant, I don't know what to do. This man won't leave me alone." So he was able to find the most vulnerable and zero in on her. And that need to destroy, I guess if we could explain it, we could work to eradicate it,
Yeah.
but it still seems to exist today.
Yeah. Well, and he really did succeed in destroying her in many ways. She was never able to trust a man again for the rest of her life, not able to fall in love. She never danced again. You know, the waste of a human being. She had some short-lived, unsuccessful marriages, but these things, although she did, thanks to participating in this film, she was vindicated by the time of her death. It was not a great life because of this one incident.
No, it wasn't. And it wasn't just him. When you talked to her, she said that as horrible as the experience was, what was also horrible was what she endured afterwards, being pointed out in court when the DA pointed at her and said, "Look at her. Who would want her?" And this humiliation, this public shaming, which was a sort of patriarchal response to a woman who tried to be the David to their Goliath.
Yeah. And such a series of betrayals from every single private and public institution and individual down to her own family. She died in 2003. How do you think that participating in this film affected her?
I think it transformed her life. I think it gave her closure. I think it gave her peace. I think it gave her pride. I think it connected her again to other people. When Vanity Fair sent its photographer and the crew up to see her, and I said to them, "You are the first people besides me to make contact with her that know about this." And they were so wonderful to her, the way they treated her. And you could see her again being that, young girl saying, "Now my key light is here. Now my best angle is here." Suddenly she was, I saw her come alive again. And it was wonderful. So I feel like she was waiting. I always felt that because there were times when I would say to myself, "Why are you tormenting this old person who wants to keep her secret?" And she would say to me, "Why are you tormenting an old lady who wants to keep her secret?" But I felt like it was characterological. If she did that as a teenager in 1937, that's who she was. And I really believed she wanted to tell that story. And it turned out that she did. She just needed the encouragement and the trust. There's another woman in the film who came forward after Patricia did, accusing an MGM executive of rape, and she had become pregnant and had to have an abortion, which was a whole other, cause of scandal and shame in that era. And they drove her out of Hollywood. She ended up hanging herself. So this was, you had asked before about whether this was common, and I think it was male privilege. These women were there for the taking, and that was how the culture worked.
Now, the film Girl 27 came out in 2007. Tell us about the life of this film, how it was received when it came out, and how its life as a film has continued, particularly as the Harvey Weinstein scandal and the Me Too movement have unfolded.
It's been a really interesting journey. It premiered at Sundance, at the Sundance Film Festival, and it was interesting to see the audience reaction because there was a sector that was fascinated by the conspiracy story and the MGM of it all and the Hollywood scandal aspect. And then there was another faction that was relating to it much more emotionally as someone who had endured a trauma and women's rights. But both of them definitely, and the film itself was seen as a single story. because there had never been a documentary about a documented rape case from that era, because there weren't any. So I think what happened, a decade later is suddenly the film took on a whole new life because it was seen as a historical predecessor of a modern day movement. And Patricia Douglas, I did an op-ed piece for the New York Times, and they called it, their headline was, a Me Too pioneer, because that's what she was. And right from the start, when the film came out, even at Sundance, people, women, would approach me after the screenings and quietly say, I'm an actress, and I just, sometimes they were very vague about it, sometimes they weren't. Sometimes they would say, this happened to me, and sometimes they would just say, I related to this film. I got an email from Kim Novak saying, I don't know what to say about this film except how much it moved me. And all of that was so meaningful to me because it was people that were starting to share an experience in an industry that had tamped down those experiences.
It's such an irony of Hollywood that they're considered in the sort of conservative media establishment to be so liberal, but they're so patriarchal in their history and up to the present day. I mean, I think Harvey Weinstein was just quoted the other day as saying, not anything like, gee, I'm sorry for what I did, but everyone does this.
Well, I don't know how that mind works. It's like another planet. I think we're all humans, and the idea of another human being abusing, degrading, destroying another human being is a fundamental evil. And I think what Patricia tried to do was speak her truth, and they silenced her voice. And I think that's the worst thing you can do to someone is silence their voice, because then it's like erasing their existence, because then what you're doing to them is making them feel they don't matter and everybody matters. So Patricia held on to this for 65 years because on some level, even if it was just a kernel, she really believed that she did not want to die without telling her story because she mattered. And I think even back in 1937, she must have felt she mattered enough to seek out justice, no matter what they were telling her. And that to me is heroic. To me, she was a hero.
And she's certainly very likable. I fell in love with her watching the film.
Oh, yeah, she's, you couldn't have, central casting couldn't have sent you. You think of an 86-year-old woman, your mind maybe conjures up someone who's meek and sweet and quiet, and she's a force of nature.
Very much so. And she really kind of opens the conversation. I mean, I was going to ask you this as a question, but I don't know that you or anybody else can answer it. It's just like a conversation that we have to keep having of what's improved in the 81 years since Patricia Douglas was raped and what hasn't.
Well, something that definitely has improved is the confessional culture we're in now encourages people to reach out to each other. And when she was raped, she was isolated. She literally remembers being on the front page of every newspaper in the country and sitting at her breakfast table with her mother and her grandparents and no one, and everyone pretending like nothing had happened. So the shame of that experience, the fact that that word wasn't fit for print, that's gone. And that's a help, because when you isolate someone and you push them away, you don't leave them with any tools for recovery because they feel worthless. And when you publicly humiliate them, like she was, that drives them into their home. I mean, or wherever it drives them. It certainly doesn't encourage them to recover. And at least that's changed.
And I think that the psychology of women who have been assaulted and who do get justice, they are able to heal and move on with their lives more powerfully than women who don't get justice or who are overtly betrayed by the institutions that are supposed to help them.
Women, men, anyone whose voice is silenced and who feels like they have lost all their power and their self-esteem, that's what's so toxic. And that's why what she endured after the rape in the criminal justice system and in the legal system and in the public. You know, her name, her photograph, her home address printed in newspapers around the country, MGM referred to as a local film studio, the most prestigious Hollywood studio in the world, isn't even identified by the newspapers. That's how protected they are.
Right.
I mean, the injustice is so egregious. How do you even process it?
David Sten's film is called Girl 27. It screens on Sunday, July 29th at 6 o'clock at the Jean Cocteau Cinema. David, you'll be doing a Q&A after the film?
Yeah, Jamie, I think, is going to moderate.
James McGrath Morris, wonderful local
yes.
author here in Santa Fe. Excellent. Good. And I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us today.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.